Lecture 17, Public and Private Morality, Part 2.
In this lecture, we continue the discussion begun in the last lecture of what principles beyond harm and offense are needed to define public morality. If Devlin's legal moralism principle presents difficulties about determining community moral standards, nonetheless, even Devlin's critics agree with one of his underlying claims, as I noted at the end of the last lecture. He says society is held together by invisible bonds of common thought, which must include shared ethical beliefs. Even Devlin's critics, like Dworkin, will agree with that. But if Devlin's own legal moral principle comes too close to the idea of one group's imposing its morals on everybody else, we perhaps still need another principle to try to handle this need about common bonds and so on. One promising candidate that suggests itself would be a public morality principle, which would say something like this. Society has a legitimate interest in protecting and encouraging attitudes, institutions, and social conditions that tend to sustain a sphere of mutual respect between persons, a moral sphere. Since this principle focuses on respect for the rights of all, it seems like a better candidate for the shared beliefs of public morality. But does it add anything substantial to the harm and offense principles? Yes, I think this public morality principle does add something substantial, and what it adds are things that accommodate the ideas of communitarians that we discussed in Lecture 11. The harm and offense principles are reactive. Liberty is to be restricted if it would cause harm or offense to others under certain conditions. This public morality principle goes further, insisting that society has a vested interest in sustaining communal bonds and supporting those institutions such as families, extended families, neighborhoods, churches, schools, which are involved in the moral education of the young. Recall that communitarians think that liberal individualist societies tend to neglect these communal bonds and supporting institutions, and I think they are onto something, and we have to accommodate, it seems to me, their ideas in this regard. It's customary to think of public morality in free societies as merely a set of rules for adjudicating conflicts between individual rights and ways of life, and we in America tend to think that way. What is missing in such an approach, as communitarians remind us, is a realization that the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are not self-sustaining. They require a moral sphere in which to exist, and this moral sphere is in turn a very fragile thing that depends for its preservation on the cultivation of institutions like families and schools and neighborhoods that create what we might call a moral ecology in which rights can survive and flourish. There's some truth in this communitarian claim, and it is accommodated, I think, by this very nice term, moral ecology. We are aware of the ecological ideas with regard to our physical environment. Perhaps we ought to add and think very seriously about the idea of the moral ecology of our own society. One of our founders, James Madison, put it this way: if there be no virtue among us, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is an illusion, unquote. So the public morality principle would guide all social policy and private initiatives having to do with the health of families, of education, including moral education, social programs dealing with teen pregnancy, drug abuse, drunk driving, disaster relief, job training, gang violence, domestic abuse, crime prevention, and numerous others that are crucial to the preservation of the moral sphere, a concern, if you will, for the moral ecology of society. As I give these lectures, and as you know, this very week, we've had a terrible tragedy in Colorado in which two young men went into the high school and they shot at least 13 or more young people, killed them, and so on. And everyone now is thinking very seriously about these matters of moral ecology and what kind of background we have here of our alienated youth and what effects have had on them of violent video games, for example, and movies and violence and other things they see on TV and all around them. These are questions that are rising in our mind today, and they're foremost in our mind because they have indeed to do with this whole question of moral ecology. And think clearly here that the harm and offense principles don't solve this problem, because they just say, you know, if the moral sphere breaks down, if there's harm or if there's offense in some ways, then we do something at that particular point. But the public morality principle is concerned with the preservation of a sphere of life, if you like, where we these kinds of things will not happen. And it is a much more difficult thing indeed to institute. William Inge once said that societies of the past were inundated from barbarians that came from outside. Modern societies, he said, breed their own from inside. And unfortunately, we have experiences of this kind. Now, naturally, there will be fierce political debates about how these things will be dealt with, teaching the young and bringing up the young within a moral ecology in which we can preserve mutual respect for one another without resorting to violence and other such things. There'll be differences of opinion here politically. Should this be done by the federal government or state governments or local governments, or should it be done by private institutions or organizations? These are political debates which I think are healthy, and they have to go on. But they surely have to be done. There's no question about it. And nowadays, I think we are learning, and we certainly learned from this Colorado incident, but from many others as well, that families alone, and even institutions like churches and so on, cannot handle this problem by themselves. If we're going to deal with this problem, it seems to me we're learning more and more that we have to deal with things like the general cultural environment. That TV and that computer and that internet, which I said was now part of our home, right inside it, not reasonable, avoidable anymore. Are we going to get the idea that things have changed, technology has changed, and so much has encroached on the family so that the family can't handle this alone anymore, and to deal with it as part of society? And what I am suggesting here, that even as a matter of public morality here, we are required to go beyond harm and offense, to go beyond the idea that, hey, we have to stop somebody and they don't have liberty when they actually do something wrong to harm somebody or offend somebody. We have to be more aware of the moral ecology here, the background, the bringing up of children, the kind of society we live in. And maybe we have to start looking at things like video games and movies and violence on TV and a host of other things. I think this is the lesson of the public morality principle, and it does, in fact, go beyond the other particular principles. But as I said, it will be a political matter to try to figure out and decide how we are going to deal with these questions, because we know that there's a conflict here between restricting things like video games and stuff and film and the whole question of free expression. I think that conflict between creating a moral ecology for the young and freedom of expression, freedom of speech, is going to be one of the biggest and most difficult issues for modern free societies to deal with. It'll be one of the big issues of a new axial period, I think, because it's absolutely crucial. Now, another thing of special importance to the task of public morality and creating a moral ecology is the crucial issue of moral education in the schools. How is it to be done in a pluralist society where there are different private moralities and conceptions of the good? This is our contemporary version of the central problem of moral education that concerned Mencius and Hume in Lecture 7. It's a daunting problem for a pluralist age, for sure, that we are far from solving. And another big issue, I think, for a new axial period. Contrary to Hume, teaching morals is a lot harder than teaching music appreciation. Although I have a niece who teaches music to elementary students, and she disputes that. There are currently three methods of teaching values in the public schools, each of which is controversial, but each of which is worth considering. The first of these methods, which was popular in the 70s and 80s, is called values clarification. It's based on the premise that in a democratic climate of value pluralism, none of us has the right to pass our values on, our particular set of values on, to other people's children. And that goes for teachers, too. So teachers must avoid imposing their values or any set of values on the students. Well, what to do then? through group discussion, according to the values clarification method, in which the teacher is supposed to remain non-judgmental, young people are encouraged to discuss their differing values in order to come to a better understanding of their values and maybe to understand the values of others, which may differ. Now, advocates of this values clarification method say it's the only way the public schools in a pluralist society can go about teaching values. And think about it a bit. You may see their point, because teachers can't impose their own personal values on the students. But debates about values clarification has been fierce. Critics say values clarification breeds relativism and subjectivism. It leads to the belief that no view is any better than any other, so long as it feels good to the one who advocates it. Well, I think we can all see how it would lead in that direction. Critics also argue that values clarification relies on the assumption that the proper attitude of society or government in the person of the public school teacher is one of neutrality to different conceptions of the good, since the students come from all different backgrounds, naturally. But perfect neutrality, the critics of values clarification argue, is not possible. If teachers do insist on remaining entirely neutral, they will in effect be promoting the position that no view is intrinsically any better than any other. It's a terrible dilemma. That would be, of course, vulgar relativism. Well, a second method of teaching values in the schools, and I'll come back to the assessment of all these eventually, a second method of teaching values in the schools is the so-called cognitive method, inspired by the influential developmental psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg, whose views have very much influenced the teaching of values in this country. The cognitive method focuses on moral reasoning capacities by presenting moral dilemmas to students and asking how they would resolve them. Critics argue that since the dilemmas offered frequently do not have clear-cut right answers, they're often rather difficult, and teachers are not supposed to impose a single right answer, the cognitive method also, according to its critics, leads to relativism and subjectivism. You may recall from Lecture 4, the existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre presented us with a dilemma about the boy who had to choose between his mother and the resistance, and so on. Well, this is like the dilemma dilemmas actually presented in some of these cognitive methods. There isn't always a clear answer. And Sartre left the impression that all moral dilemmas are like this, tough to call, and there are no rules that can help us. We must ultimately trust our instincts. Well, the critics of cognitive methods suggest that that seems to be the implication that they often leave as well, again, subjectivism or relativism. Well, the third method of teaching values in the schools is a response of sorts to the perceived failings of these other two, which have been popular. This third method is the teaching of basic values or character education in the schools starting in the younger grades. This is an approach that has become popular in recent years with the revival of virtue ethics, which we discussed in Lecture 12. Here, developments in philosophy have paralleled those in society at large, an interest in virtue ethics here and going back to the ideas of virtue. The idea in this case, in the schools, is to teach certain basic virtues or traits of character as fundamental for living in a civilized society. It's an approach that would have appealed to both Hume and Mencius, for sure, as you recall. Different tables of virtues have been suggested and used in different state and local school systems, but they are often overlapping. For instance, one standard, commonly used set, is the six pillars of character proposed by the Josephson Institute's Aspen Declaration of 1992, now used in a number of different school systems. They suggest six virtues. I have only five fingers here, sorry. They suggest six virtues: trustworthy, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring, and civic involvement or citizenship. Alternative state education, pretty interesting group, I think. Alternative state educational groups and local systems have come up with four virtues: honesty, caring, respect, and responsibility. But they more or less overlap with the six of the Josephson Institute if you align honesty with trustworthiness. Such character education in basic virtues, I think, goes some way to responding to the charges of lack of specific content, at least those charges, leveled against values clarification and cognitive methods. For here we have specific content in the form of character traits and virtues. Let's take the six of the Josephson Institute. This is one reason, I think, for the popularity of virtues education in recent years. Yet there have been criticisms of this approach as well. For example, different state and local citizenship groups have come up with different lists of virtues. So the old problem relativism might rear its head again here, as it did in the case of Mencius and Hume. As always, there are laundry lists of virtues when you approach ethics in this way through virtues. Yet in this case, the virtues frequently overlap, as we saw above. So the philosophical question that should interest us is this: what's the rationale for the virtues chosen? Well, a Wisconsin citizenship task force that looked into this matter for character education in the schools suggested a rationale. They said the virtues chosen should represent a core set of citizenship values essential to our democratic society. Well, this is a very interesting idea, which is precisely in line with our public morality principle. And it seems to track the notion of public morality. Those virtues essential for a democratic society. I would put it this way. The values or virtues chosen for public morality to be taught in the schools are not meant to tell us in full detail how to live or what is the best form of life. That's for each of us to work out in the business of living. The values or virtues chosen for the school should rather be dedicated to answering a different kind of question altogether. Not how do we live in full detail. We have to work that out ourselves. But how do we live together, given that we have different views about how to live? Consider, by way of example, then, the six virtues of the Josephson Institute: trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring, and civic involvement. They all point in this direction: how to live together, given that we may have different views about how to live. Indeed, as far as I can see, they all are implied in one way or another by the idea of treating other persons as ends in themselves and not mere means to one's own ends. Trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring, civic involvement. Minor differences in the tables of virtues recommended should not confuse us, therefore, with suggestions of relativism. If we understand the underlying rationale of public morality, say the idea of treating everybody with respect or equally, then we can see that there is a common set or core here that we could come up with. But again, I would add that even though this virtues approach seems to have something going for it, there's still a place for values clarification and cognitive methods in moral education. For one thing, it's important to understand the different values of others if we are going to treat them with trust, respect, fairness, and care. Where values clarification and the cognitive methods go wrong, I think, is requiring that the teacher be non-judgmental. Now, of course, the argument is that this is required to avoid the teacher imposing his or her own views on other people's children. But this argument, I think, rests on a confusion that was exposed in my earlier lectures. If we start with openness to other ways of life, in other words, being non-judgmental, if you will, as the values clarification wishes to do, we can't end up by asserting that every view is as good as every other. To the contrary, if we start by being open and non-judgmental, it turns out that some views, if they're acted upon, would make themselves less worthy of respect by breaking the moral sphere and making it impossible for others to treat them with respect and everyone else as well. Here is what I think teachers and parents ought to say when children are continuously bombarded nowadays through the media, TV, and other places, as they are today, with different points of view in the global village. Teachers, and indeed parents, here's what I suggest. Be open, if you wish, to other points of view. This may be the correct attitude to start with if you want to find the truth. But just remember that this attitude of openness or tolerance does not mean anything goes, ethically speaking. Quite the contrary, trying to sustain an attitude of openness under adverse conditions leads to the conclusion that some ways of living and acting are really right and others wrong, and some more worthy of respect and others less worthy, those who break the moral sphere, making it impossible for us to respect them and others too. So we can sit around trying to understand each other's values, all right, as in the values clarification method, But don't think that means we have to take an equal attitude to those whose ways of life involve killing, lying, stealing, cheating, or otherwise exploiting others, treating others as means and not as ends. We can't treat these equally. The very principles of openness and tolerance with which we started tell us we must be judgmental when it comes to such things. If you start off being open and tolerant, you must, in the end, be judgmental. And this goes for the teachers as well as the students. So the teachers need not sit back mutely without any judgment or passing any judgment. And similarly, the students. In such manner, the values clarification method would converge with the teaching of virtues, such as trustworthy, respect, responsibility, fairness, and caring. Clarification of values, without the confusions often attending it, would lead to these very virtues. To conclude this lecture, I want to turn back to a general theme of public morality. We have been trying to spell it out in terms of liberty-limiting principles, such as Mill's harm principle, the offense principle, and now have tried to add this public morality principle, which would try through moral education and in other ways to create a moral ecology in society, which in part one hopes would combat the kinds of tragedies we have had this week. But there is one other controversial liberty-limiting principle that has to be added to the mix for a full account of public morality. It's sometimes called the paternalism principle. To what degree can the liberty of individuals in a free society be limited by law or government to prevent persons not from doing harm or offense to others, but from doing harm to themselves? As John Stuart Mill argued, the presumption of free societies is always for liberty, since that's the best way to respect others, even if persons use their liberty in ways that will harm themselves. That's true for adults, at least. Mill made some exceptions on paternalism for children. And clearly, we need paternalistic legislation for children. For example, restrictions on underage drinking, or advertising to children, and all the rest. Even Mill would have allowed that sort of thing. But paternalism to adults seems like a much more complicated business in a free society, where we run into the justification for controversial laws restricting liberty to adults, like gambling or drug legislation or prostitution or anti-sodomy laws, or even mandating things like motorcycle helmets or seat belts, so on. To initially test one's intuitions on this matter of paternalism, because there are people like who follow Mill or even go further than Mill, and say, gee, we shouldn't have any legislation whatever restricting liberty when it comes to an adult doing harm to themselves. Well, we need to test our intuitions on this. And I suggest we do so with a rather unusual example that's part of American history. And that's the example of dueling. You recall that dueling is illegal, but it wasn't always in American history. It was illegal. It was legal through a good slice of our history. I guess we know the story of Alexander Hamilton, was it, and Aaron Burr, and other challenges between senators and congressmen in the Congress during the 19th century. Laws against dueling are now taken for granted, but they are clearly paternalistic. They protect proud and foolish men from letting their pride and foolishness lead to putting their lives on the line. I suspect that if dueling had been legal during the recent impeachment process in Washington, several senators and congressmen would now be dead. Perhaps I'm here undercutting the argument against it. I don't know, but in any case, more relevant paternalistic legislation concerns other things having to do with government regulation, however. For instance, consider the regulation of dangerous foods and prescription drugs and other consumer goods, the work of the FDA, product safety commissions. This is often paternalistic legislation, and it's perennially controversial, like much else in public morality. Some people say following Mill in a free society, wherever possible, we should first inform people of the dangers of, say, foods and drugs and let them make their own free decisions. Some people like to say that about our anti-drug laws now. There's a movement, of course, for the legalization of drugs in some of these respects. So the suggestion is we should inform rather than ban when it comes to people harming themselves. Hence, we get warning labels on cigarettes, and pharmacists' lists of possible side effects of prescription drugs, which are often very hard to read, as you know, and things like that. What's the principle here? Well, in the case of paternalism, The idea would be, since if people are only harming themselves and they're adults, inform wherever you can, letting persons make their own choices, and ban only when necessary. I think that's a very significant qualification we have to make to the paternalism principle for adults. And it wouldn't mean, by the way, that we would never just have to ban something. I think a very interesting case here is the case of Claudine. Claudine is that very, very powerful and dangerous nerve-damaging chemical that was used for many years for termites. You know, you get your house termited, and they come in and they spray around it. Claudine was the thing they used for years and years. Well, it's now banned. They officially tried to simply inform people that it was dangerous, but the information wasn't getting out there. Because for one thing, to use Claudine is a lot cheaper than the other substitutes they have for it. And so all the companies that were doing your termiting were using it. Otherwise, they would have to charge $400 or $500 more per house. Well, you can see there's something going wrong here in the free marketplace. Because in order to get the cheapest price, they were all using the most dangerous chemical. Well, the way to go in here is just get rid of it. And in fact, Claudine has been banned. So here's a case where you have a qualification for paternalism, which says, in effect, inform people first, put labels on cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera. But there are going to be cases where information just isn't going to get across. I remember when I was first trying to find out about Claudine, I tried to call the state agencies, and they told me, before it was banned, that is, and I was going to get my house termited, they told me, no problem. These are bureaucrats for you. 2 weeks later, it was banned nationally. So I had to get my information by calling up the Disease Control Center in Atlanta. You can't usually do that. I had to pull something like I was a big professor or something. And I talked with the fellow there, and he told me about its dangers. So there's a very, very interesting case, I think, where paternalism comes into play. And I think a case that I don't have time here to discuss at great length, but is also important these days to people, is physician-assisted suicide. Here is a very interesting paternalistic issue in society, I think, today. Because, again, the normal idea would be inform people. Make it clear to them about what their physical condition is, how much pain and suffering, and let people make their own free decisions. That's one way of looking at the physician-assisted suicide issue, is to put it up to the free decision. But the question arises whether people in a condition of sickness, whether they're thinking properly, whether they're in a depressed mood or something, whether information will get across to them. Are they thinking clearly? Are they thinking straight? And so on. In other words, the same old principle with paternalism here. Is information enough to handle the business? That's very important. So as we slowly work out the issue here of physician-assisted suicide in society, it's going to be like that. How can we avoid any kind of abuse of this situation, where a dying person is not, so to speak, bumped off by the relatives, anxious to inherit, or otherwise not in a condition to make an informed decision about this, and how much can be left to the individuals? I think this is an extremely difficult case right now. I think there are good arguments you can give on each side. People do want more control over their dying, because now we have the means of keeping them alive indefinitely in conditions which are sometimes intolerable. So I think we're going to have to work that out, but it is a very clear example of the paternalism principle here in morality. So public morality in general covers a lot of things. If you include both the harm principle, the offense principle, the public morality principle, and the paternalism principle. But it doesn't cover all of the issues that are controversial and bother us in society and are in some ways the most controversial. And I will conclude with one comment about this. If public morality has a broader scope than we might think, it still leaves certain contentious issues undecided. And I think one of the primary examples of these today is abortion. I don't think the principles of public morality we've come up with, as broad as they are in scope, and I've tried to emphasize that, are going to handle all of our contentious present moral issues. And I think abortion is a very good example of a case that public morality simply can't handle. Why? Because public morality insists that we treat everybody and every person with equal respect as an end and not a means. And the problem with abortion is that there is now bitter dispute and debate about the status of the fetus. Is the fetus a person with those rights to be treated as an end? And when does it become so? At the moment of conception or later on? Biology doesn't quite answer this, and religious views about it differ. And as long as that is the fact, then abortion is going to be a continuing moral struggle for pluralist societies, which must continue to rely on second-best strategies, like majority vote, I'm afraid, to deal with it. That seems sad, but nonetheless, public morality can't handle anything. We have ongoing problems that we have to slowly work out and get answers to. Thank you.